right. On to ideology. Let's see, pass these. Everybody have a outline? Just to remind you of this, the last 2 weeks of the semester, how we're going to proceed. There are four lectures left, because we are going to meet next week, and that will be the four topics on ideology. The weekend is where we will discuss the socialism and transformation theme. It's the organization of the weekend. I think I sent everybody, did I send everyone a sort of brief schedule for the weekend, how it's going to be done? So I think it'll be a nice, varied event. There will be the students from the Theory of the State class, and five of them will be doing this simulated ASA, American Sociological Association panel. So their term paper assignments had several components, but one of them was to pick a book that grew out of a dissertation, to pretend that they had written it, so to read it and assimilate it enough that they fully are in control of that particular book, and then to prepare a 20-minute presentation as if it was their year on the job market and they were going to the American Sociological Association presenting their paper on a Theory of the State panel. So that's a daunting task that grad students hopefully face at some point. That is how to distill a complicated piece of work into a 20-minute talk that isn't excruciatingly boring. Because if you attempt to simply summarize a book in 20 minutes, it's usually boring. What you have to do is figure, it's a whole separate skill, how to identify a punchline, some idea or point that really is going to grab people, and then build a 20-minute talk from that point, rather than take the book and try to distill it, right? It's a different way of thinking about it. So we're going to have a panel so you'll be the audience that wandered into the session, and then the other students in the class will be the other scholars who are working on the same themes who came to that session. So that's what we'll do that'll be the Saturday afternoon slot. Then the morning, Saturday morning is going to be on socialism and real utopias as a way of thinking about alternatives to capitalism. And Sunday morning will be transformation, how to get from here to there. And those discussions, the students from the other class will not in general have read the material that's slated in the syllabus for this, although I gave them the core assignments. I also don't expect you, in the context of both having the ideology sections that we're working on and writing your third paper, to have done all the reading for that. So just try to read into some of the key pieces that are in the syllabus. In the memo that I sent around, I indicated what were the most important. But I'm going to treat this more as just a kind of open set of discussions on these themes. So I'll give a much shorter presentation than I do here, maybe 20 minutes, half hour at most, and then we'll just have a freewheeling discussion on these themes on the weekend and explore Black Hawk Island. All right, ideology. This is the last of the kind of big core concepts, clusters of concepts for the course. So we had capitalism, class, the state, and now state and politics, and now ideology. I think that Terborn's book on ideology, in my judgment, is the best systematic exploration of this problem of any that I know of, that actually works on the concept in a way that becomes really useful and isn't mainly just a polemic of one sort or another. What I want to do here is to explicate his approach, emphasizing some things and doing some work on it. I'll have some other suggestions for how to think about the problem that aren't quite as clear, perhaps, in his. And then this will set the stage for our more specific discussions in the next three lectures around particular aspects of ideology. First thing to, though, just clear up is that the word ideology gets used in a lot of different ways. Terborn's use comes out of the Althusserian tradition of Marxist theory, although I think he is a big substantive improvement over Althusser's specific use. But there's other uses. So one definition of ideology sees ideology as false ideas. Ideology is the other of science. So you have science versus ideology. That's one way of thinking it. Ideology is then a diagnosis of the content of a body of ideas. And there's other possible contents. There's a science. You can have a body of ideas that are scientific and a body of ideas that are ideological. That's one way of using the word ideology. Another way that's very common in sociology is to say everybody has beliefs about politics, but only some people have ideological beliefs about politics. And the contrast is how systematic and coherent are the beliefs. Do they constitute a configuration that is internally coherent so that it can yield answers to new questions for a person? So some people have mishmashes of ideologies where they're conservative in some respects, radical in other respects, Christian in some respects, secular in other respects. They just have a kind of mishmash, and they don't worry about it all hanging together. Whereas other people approach politics ideologically, meaning not that their ideas are false or true, it doesn't have anything to do with the ideology science, but that they're systematic rather than chaotic. Systematized gestalts of beliefs is another way of thinking of ideology. So it's ideology versus chaos or incoherence. Neither of these are the ways that Terborn uses the term. They're not wrong. I mean, you know, words are words, and these are perfectly well-established uses of the term ideology. But it'll be misleading and confusing if you think that that's what's going on in Terborn's use. Terborn is using ideology as a multidimensional concept that maps all socially relevant aspects of subjectivity. It's a multidimensional idea. We'll get into the dimensions. And it's basically about the socially relevant aspects of your subjectivity. We'll give it a little more precision shortly, but there's no such thing as an ideology. You don't evaluate ideologies on the basis of whether they're true or false, whether they're coherent or incoherent. It's not that you can't evaluate belief systems that way. There's nothing in Terborn that says that's not a relevant thing to do, but it's not what renders them ideological or not ideological. The simplest way of thinking about it is ideologies is any system of beliefs. So you can have a scientific ideology. That is, you have a system of beliefs that you hold dear and that actually affect the way you operate in the world. And it turns out that the system of beliefs that you hold are also scientific. That's just a scientific ideology from the point of view of this use of the term ideology. We need to make one other distinction, I think, just to get the language clear. This is probably a little clearer. I'm going to make it a little clearer than Terborn, and that's the distinction between an ideology, using it as a noun, and ideological practices, using it as an adjective. So an ideology is a system of beliefs. And therefore, you can talk about how coherent is this ideology. Is it a systematic or a chaotic ideology? It's just any system of beliefs. How idiosyncratic or shared is it? But an ideology just refers to the system of beliefs. Ideological practices refers to the process of producing beliefs that are incorporated within subjectivity. That's what an ideological practice is. An ideological practice is the human activity of producing beliefs that are incorporated into subjectivity. Now, that's not quite the same as the ideological practices by which beliefs themselves are produced, or at least not by which, perhaps to say more clearly, it's not the same as the practices by which ideas are produced. It's the practices by which ideas become incorporated as subjectivity. That's why what we're doing in this class is an ideological practice in Terborn's case. It's not all that we're doing, but partially what we're doing, both what I'm doing in my speaking to you and what you're doing in your listening and having internal conversations with yourself about what I'm saying, and in our discussions, what we're all doing is incorporating beliefs into our subjectivity. We, and I mean we because it includes me, end each class with different elements to our cognitive structures than we began with, at least if we were awake during the class and paying any attention. And that's the process of, that's what ideological practices are all about, the process by which beliefs are incorporated into subjectivity. As in the previous discussion of political practices, the idea of an ideological practice, now ideology as an adjective before practice, the idea of an ideological practice fits within a whole menu of practices. So the specificity of each kind of practice is specified or identified by its contrast to other kinds of practices. Just to recapitulate, with all of these, with all practices, the kind of format for thinking about human activity in this way is to imagine that there's some kind of raw material on which human beings act in a transformation process. You produce something using means of production, and you end up with a product of some sort. And you can distinguish different kinds of practices by the means of production used. The means of practice, perhaps, would be a better general term, or the means of transformation of that practice, and the kind of product, and the input. What are the raw materials that are being produced? So economic practices use ordinary means of production to produce use values. That's what an economic practice does, transforms nature into use values. Political practices produce social relations. Ideological practices produce the conscious dimensions of subjectivity through a transformation of lived experience into beliefs. So the raw material of ideological practices are lived experiences, and what they get transformed into are beliefs. Ideology is cognitive. It affects the way you think. The notion of ideology only makes sense if you regard human beings as agents capable of action. They have, you know, it's only relevant because of an agent view of human activity. Cultural practices, I draw a distinction between ideological practices and cultural practices. Terborn doesn't draw this distinction very clearly. It's kind of tacit in some of his arguments, but I think there's a lack of clarity on this issue in the book. I defined cultural practices as the process of producing the non-conscious dimensions of subjectivity. So ideology produces cognitive beliefs, the conscious thinking aspects of subjectivity. Culture produces the non-conscious aspects, and especially the affective, emotional components of our subjectivity. And a key aspect of both of cultural and ideological practices is how these things get connected. Right? So when you have a set of beliefs that trigger anger at certain groups, the anger part isn't just a belief. The anger part is something that's fueled by symbols and all sorts of other things that operate unconsciously on the emotional states of actors and connect them to certain kinds of beliefs. Cultural practices produce aspects of personality and dispositions, ideological practices produce the beliefs that get connected to those dispositions. To use the kind of Bourdieu framework, cultural practices produce habitus. That is, your ingrained, automatic, unthinking dispositions to act in particular ways in particular settings. We can therefore distinguish, for example, and this will become clarified later, we can distinguish between patriarchal ideologies and patriarchal culture. Patriarchal ideologies have a whole set of beliefs about the differences between men and women, about the proper roles for men and women, and about the possibilities of change. So remember, Terborn defines these three dimensions of cognitive dimensions of ideology, answers to the questions what exists, what is possible, and what is good. And patriarchal ideologies give answers to that with respect to gender issues. Patriarchal culture, on the other hand, creates a set of dispositions, inner emotional states and dispositions that are connected to those beliefs. So just as an example, the patriarchal ideology says it is a good thing for men to be aggressive and competitive and assertive. That's part of what a patriarchal ideology says about the differences between men and women on the normative level. Men should be aggressive, hard-hitting, assertive. Women should be meek, deferential, etc. I'm giving a very old-fashioned, stylized account. That doesn't mean that any individual man actually has the disposition to be aggressive. For that, the man has to be socialized into a patriarchal culture where they learn how to be aggressive and competitive and assertive and domineering. That takes training, and it has to be embodied in the Bourdieu sense as part of their dispositions or their habitus. There are many men who are only incompletely socialized as men in that sense, and that's one of the tensions and one of the sources of transformation, one of the levers for transformation, is disjunctures between culture and ideology. And how you play off of that disjuncture is really an interesting topic. In the feminist movement, in the women's liberation movement of the 1970s, one of the key mechanisms of social change was what in the time was called consciousness raising. And the idea was that a group of women would get together and operate at the ideological level. That is, they would say, we have changed our beliefs in order to change our dispositions. So they would engage in assertiveness training. Well, what is assertiveness training? It says, I already have the belief that it's a good thing for women to be more assertive, but I don't know how to do it well. And I never feel comfortable doing it. And so you have assertiveness training to change the inner dispositions to correspond to the new ideology. Similarly for men. Men were in men's groups back in the 70s. I was in a men's group, a feminist men's group. That is, it was self-consciously designed for us to think through the problem about how to become the kind of men we wanted to be, given our views, our already changed ideology about how we should be. And, you know, I don't know how successful it was, but we had fun trying. Well, that's just an example. I think that's the way to think about that is ideology and culture aren't the same. Shouldn't just mush them all together into some seamless whole. We have cognitive beliefs that we think about consciously. This is how I think the world works. And we have dispositions, some of which are deeply embodied, you know, really, and embodied in the bodily sense. You know, you feel it in your body. When these things don't correspond, you feel uncomfortable in the world. And that discomfort is one of the sources of transformation. It's what can motivate changing things. Yeah?
Well, I think you've addressed it quite a bit. But besides the like explicit actions of like consciousness raising, you know, to what degree does ideology inform culture? Or to what degree does culture inform ideology?
Well,
because you're talking about them in somewhat autonomous
way. Right, so the word inform can mean a whole lot of different things. If you mean constrain, certain kinds of ideas will fit more comfortably with certain sorts of dispositions. and certain kinds of dispositions will fit more comfortably with certain kinds of ideas. So if you take a kind of functionalist perspective, one might want to argue there will be a tendency, all things considered, for there to be mutual adjustments between ideology and culture until so that they can go together as harmonious couplets. Theories of cognitive dissonance and of adaptive preference formation. I mean, there's all sorts of social psychological theories that bear on the problem of creating harmony, internal harmony between emotional states, dispositions to act, and the cognitive beliefs we hold. When we talk about mystification, and particularly in the last lecture when we talked about the micro foundations of ideology, we'll be talking about some of these psychological processes. And the way to think about them is these are hardwired internal psychological processes that lead to internal adjustments between the things we believe and the things we feel. And that's a kind of relationship between ideology and culture. But the disharmony, but I think what the mistake is to assume that harmony is some natural state and disharmony is an unnatural state. I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's just as natural to be in disequilibrium internally, to feel stress, to feel anxiety, to feel out of place in the world, to feel that your ideas and your dispositions don't match, and to be perpetually unsuccessful in bringing them into alignment. And then sometimes to be in a social context where that's shared with other people and there's mutual recognition of this as an issue, and then internal reflexivity, thinking about thinking and thinking about your feelings and so on, and these cultural and ideological aspects, those reflexive moments combined with collective processes can lead to quite radical transformation. That latent possibility is there, I think, all the time. And it's the one of the keys for social movements. Transformation is that sometimes you can't mobilize that. A lot of the mobilization depends upon the capacity to make people aware that it's shared. That was another one of the key insights of the women's movement, was breaking down the isolation of each individual person feeling that this was their own personal problem and rendering it a public problem shared with others is what then made it possible to have individual transformation. You know, it's not just that it made possible collective transformation through collective action, it made it a hell of a lot easier for individual women to transform their own dispositions and subjectivity when there was a really full recognition that this was shared with other people, as opposed to you just feeling individually isolated, crummy, out of sorts, that your dispositions and ideas aren't fitting. That's one of the, I think, core of the insights of the, and of the historical practice of the women's liberation movement in this second wave feminism of the 60s and 70s. Notions like the personal is political, consciousness raising, assertive, some of these things get caricatured, you know, assertiveness training can be easily caricatured, you know, practicing being assertive. But I don't think it should be belittled and kind of sneered at. I mean, it's an absolutely fundamental thing to do. In a world where being assertive enables you to be autonomous, I mean, that's the idea is not assertiveness training so you too can be a nasty dominator. It's assertiveness training so that you can hold your own in the context of the inevitable, you know, conflicts and relations you have to engage in. Okay, well, that's this ideology culture and interplay, and it's why I think it's very helpful to distinguish these. Now, of course, again, these are words, so there's culture as the kind of overarching term. In sociology, the term culture is used in ways that typically subsumes what I'm calling ideology. When Ann Swidler, one of the prominent current cultural sociologists, talks about culture as a toolkit, she's including everything that I'm calling ideology, because a lot of the toolkit concerns beliefs about what exists, what is good, and what is possible. The debates about cultural framing, you know, you frame a problem, is really about cognitive issues. The abortion debate is a fantastically good one for this. Having the brilliance of deciding that pro-life was the right way to frame the issue of abortion Now that's a cognitive move. It's a way of classifying the world. We have a set of practices which affirm life and a set of practices that deny life. And they're a binary. And there may be ambiguities. I mean, the sheer fact of framing that way doesn't necessarily imply that there are no ambiguous cases, but it does define a domain of policies, which if you buy into the framing, then it's very hard to be pro-abortion. Pro-choice was the alternative. So that's a really interesting case of a normative asymmetry between the two sides of this debate. It's not just pro-abortion, anti-abortion. So pro-abortion, anti-abortion, abortion rights, anti-abortion rights. That's a more descriptive set of classifications of the policies. Pro-life versus pro-choice are completely asymmetric ideas. They're classifying the world along completely distinct dimensions. Now, if you were just in general asked the question, you know, life is filled with conflicts and trade-offs. If you had to make a trade-off between life and choice, which is more important? You know, I mean, I super value autonomy. I think choice is great, but over life, I mean, you know, give me a break. So that's an example, I think, where a cognitive move, a classification exercise, how do we classify this phenomenon? Which is, you know, where does it fit into our descriptive, our descriptions of the world, resonates with cultural aspects, because, you know, these values have deep emotional resonances. They're part of our culture. Autonomy and choice is certainly an important part of bourgeois, sort of Western culture, but so is life. And the deployment of cultural symbols in ideological debates in shaping the framing, you know, is what makes this process work in the ideological struggles that it involved. Okay, well, this was a little detour in the comment about Swidler's. So Swidler says culture is a toolkit. The toolkit includes all these ideas. You can package them in different ways. That's what culture is all about. Well, she has subsumed ideology under culture. So she's using culture as the umbrella concept for all shared forms of subjectivity-forming practices. That's kind of big C culture. I'm using culture as a counterpoint to ideology to define those aspects of subjectivity formation that are connected to, you know, symbols, emotions, disposition formation, and using ideology in the narrower sense to deal with the cognitive aspects. And then to ask the question, how do these fit together? How do they reinforce each other? How do they contradict each other? And how they contradict each other, I think, is the most interesting question. And it's at the heart of social change. I mean, after all, I mean, I'm belaboring this point. Why would you bother developing Marxist theory and trying to convince people about it if you didn't believe that changing people's beliefs about how the world worked could be a lever for changing their dispositions about how to act in the world? And that's, of course, the whole underlying rationale. The rationale for then doing this kind of stuff lies in there being possible contradictions between ideology and culture, you know, to state it in a perhaps not conventional way. One final kind of practice, theoretical practice. That's the term that Althusser uses. I don't remember if in the ideology book Terborn ever uses that expression, theoretical practice. One might want to also, I think, more commonsensically call it scientific practice rather than theoretical practice. So theoretical practice is the process of producing knowledge of social relations through the transformation of ideology as a raw material. So now think about this a little bit. Ideology is what people actually believe. What science does is interrogate what people actually believe and transform these common sense beliefs into knowledge, which is evaluated on various criteria through various procedures. They can be good or bad procedures. They can produce more or less reliable knowledge. They can produce more or less cumulative knowledge. So theoretical practices, to use the Althusserian term, or I think it's probably a little clearer to say scientific practices. What's the product? Knowledge. What's the product of ideological practice? Beliefs. Beliefs and knowledge are two different kinds of products of human activity. Knowledge, once it becomes incorporated into the subjectivity of a person, is also a belief. Right? So, you know, a kind of simple example, we are all, or I assume all of us, believe in evolutionary biology. That's part of our belief structure, that we believe that animals evolve through some kind of process of natural selection. Those are our beliefs. Christian fundamentalists believe that animals were the direct result of the design of God. These are both beliefs. They both have the same kind of status in our cognition. It's not that our beliefs are located in some different part of the brain because they're scientific than the beliefs of creationists. They're in the same part of the cognitive structure of our, I don't know, cerebellum or wherever it is. My neuroscience is a little shaky. So we have in our brains a neurological structure capable of sustaining beliefs which we can recognize through consciousness. That's the complicated aspect of being a sentient being. The truth value of those beliefs has nothing to do with whether they are beliefs. They are beliefs incorporated into our subjectivity which inform the way we act and think and talk in the world. But we can also diagnose those beliefs. And we can diagnose them through different protocols. And one of those protocols has the capacity to differentiate beliefs in terms of their knowledge content. It's a distinctly human achievement to create that kind of capacity, those protocols. We call them scientific. It's a kind of shorthand for something that's a lot more complicated. And it's a way of evaluating the content of ideology. So of the ideologies, the actually incorporated beliefs that we have. So it's not that ideologies are in the first instance to be thought of as true or false. Ideologies are just beliefs. But then we can also evaluate them in terms of whether they're true or false. True or false in the sense of, according to the canons of scientific evaluation, to what extent do these beliefs, are they validated and supported by available evidence and argument? That's what a theoretical practice does. It interrogates, through a particular set of human practices, the truth content of the beliefs we hold. But then when you actually hold them, they still are beliefs. And you can see why this is different from seeing ideology as the other of science. Ideology and science are two different domains of human practice, but they are relevant to each other. Science provides one of the bases for evaluating the one aspect of the content of beliefs. There are many other ways of evaluating the content of beliefs. You can evaluate the content of beliefs in terms of, do they make you happy? You know, so we can have an assessment of beliefs in the sense of which ones make it easy to live in the world and which ones make it hard to live in the world. So some beliefs people hold are self-destructive. They hold beliefs which, when they act on those beliefs, lead to harms to themselves. That doesn't mean the beliefs are false or true. It just is a diagnosis of a particular aspect of those beliefs. And whether they are false or true is another way of evaluating beliefs. But to do that, you have to distinguish scientific practices from cultural practices, from ideological practices. Okay. This way of just generally approaching human activity, the practices framework derived from the Althusserian tradition, I find particularly congenial, obviously. I push this throughout the semester. I do so partially because of the motivation behind the whole enterprise of developing this kind of theory, which is to try to figure out how to transform the world in ways that will make it better. So if transformation is the guts of what the whole point is, then thinking of human action primarily, or at least in the first instance, in terms of its transformation dimensions is a congenial interface between the motivations for the whole theoretical enterprise and the way we diagnose and evaluate the activities of people. So, given all that, let me give you then, I think this is in the, where's the notes here? So let me give you the first formal definition. This is under 2.1, under Roman numeral 1, of ideology. Ideological practice is the social process through which conscious subjectivity is formed through the real activities of people engaged in social relations, in which what happens to them, their experiences, are transformed into cognitive products. Lived experience is the raw material. Ideological practices are an activity. What they produce are incorporated beliefs. Another just recapitulation. Remember, I've distinguished between types of practice and aspects or dimensions of practice. When we talked about political practice, I distinguished between politics, which was a way of talking about political practices as a type of practice, and the political aspects of practice. So if political practices more generally are practices that produce social relations, we could talk about the political aspects of an economic practice. Same thing you can do about ideological practices. So if ideological practices are the practices which produce subjectivity, cultural practices produce the non-conscious aspects of subjectivity, ideological practices produce the cognitive aspects, sometimes those are byproducts of other activities. They're not themselves the direct purpose of the activity. To talk about an ideological practice, when one does ideology, what that means is the central task of that practice is producing subjectivity. That's why in a classroom what I'm engaged in here is an ideological practice. My purpose is to affect your subjectivity. I hope in a way that has this character of reciprocities and of autonomy, so that I'm not trying to impose a subjectivity on you, but I'm trying to affect it by stimulating your own reflexive chewing over the issues that get raised. But nevertheless, this is an ideological practice. Propaganda machines are clear examples of an ideological practice. TV ads for candidates are trying to shape your beliefs. That's their whole purpose. Other things are just byproducts. It's not that the purpose of the activity is to change, affect beliefs, but that's a byproduct of what goes on. When a foreman walks up and down the line and checks on how hard workers are working, the purpose is to be sure that they were working hard enough. It's engaged in the domination relations within the economic practices of a capitalist firm to assure that enough effort is being performed. But a byproduct of those interactions is reinforcing a set of beliefs about what is, what exists, what is good, and what is possible. Reinforcing a set of beliefs about the kind of normal, expected, everyday nature of the world in which a person lives. Okay, we've already talked about ideology, culture, consciousness, and non-consciousness, so I think I don't need to say more about that. And also about this fundamental issue for transformation, the contradiction between ideological and cultural practices. And therefore, you know, really, to this is another instance of getting away from the functionalist assumption about how everything fits together to create a nicely, smoothly reproducing system, and rather to see how well things fit together in a nicely reproductive way is contingent and contested, and that there will be just as inherent tendencies for culture and ideology to contradict each other, for different aspects of ideology to contradict each other, as for them to all fit together. And that actually it takes a lot of work to make things run smoothly. It's not something that is spontaneously given by simply the functioning of the system. Now let's turn to...
Sorry, one question. I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to the action of when subjectivity first kind of shapes your ideology, but then when your ideology kind of reciprocates and starts to shape your subjectivity. I'm thinking specifically of just like American politics and people who refuse, who have a subjective experience, but then try to fit it into their ideology instead of reshaping their ideology to reflect what they just observed.
So, well, first of all, the expression subjectivity affects ideology isn't, in this framework, wouldn't be a coherent statement, because it, subjectivity is ideology. That is, subjectivity means the beliefs that you hold, the conscious beliefs you hold as the conscious aspects of subjectivity. Okay, so what you mean, what you could say is that lived experience, what's happening to you, may contradict or reinforce the beliefs you hold, and then how do you adjust? How do you, when they don't fit together, what adjusts? This is what in Terborn's analysis would be referred to as situations where there's a contradiction between qualification and subjugation, which will be clearer. I mean, I'll be getting to that in a moment. That is when you're when the beliefs that have been inculcated over time that you've been subjected to no longer qualify you to function in the world. That is, they contradict your lived experience and how those adjust. I don't think the answer to the question, how do they adjust, is not a formula, as far as I know. There are two kinds of adjustments that can occur, but it's contingent exactly what happens. There are internal cognitive processes, such as cognitive dissonance and adaptive preference formation, which we'll discuss in the last lecture, by which people change their beliefs to correspond to the reality. They adjust their beliefs. So the sour grapes story of the of Aesop's fable, where the fox wants the grapes, keeps jumping for them, can't reach them, and decides that the grapes are sour anyway. Right? So the fox begins with a belief that those grapes are delicious. They become unattainable. It's clear that the fox can't get them. And the resolution of that tension between what the limits of possibility and the beliefs about the world are that the fox changes the beliefs about the world. They wouldn't taste good anyway. That's a way of making the fox happier from the frustration of not being able to get the beliefs. Well, that's a paradigm. Sour grapes is a paradigm of how a person might change their beliefs to adapt to the realities in the face of a contradiction between their beliefs about how the world is and their desires. But that's not the only possible change. If it wasn't a fox but a person, and there were a lot of people who were frustrated because of their beliefs about something desirable that would be good for them but they can't get, but then they come to realize that if they work together they might be able to get it, they might change the reality in order to realize their beliefs. I call that class struggle. So it's not inherent the case that the psychological tricks of dissonance form reduction, that's what that particular Aesop's fable is about, that the psychological tricks of self-deception and the like always triumph, but they can. That's one of the contexts. Jan Elster, in the material that we'll be reading, one of his big punchlines is that there's a set of these psychological mechanisms that explain the change in beliefs. But there is no general theory possible of under what conditions do people do these adaptive internal things versus trying to change the world. There's no general theory of that. It's very context specific how people respond. These just create the tensions which lead to some kind of response. Yeah.
I think though in general, like there is something to say about. So if basically from what
what this dimension of, I mean, I'm sorry, what this definition of what ideology and subjectivity are. Subjectivity is the product of transformed product of ideological practice, right? Or that exists in society. And then does that imply, or at least can we say anything about the priority of ideology, like in a sense of it exists prior to this, the formation of the subject?
Well, everybody is born into a world which is already formed. So of course, belief systems that are shared by the people in which you live exist prior to your having any beliefs.
Right, but in the sense of the subject is also a source of agency, is it not? Subjectivity. And then if that's the case, then how do you draw the line between where... because ultimately, any form of human agency is going to be molded by subjectivity and formed
it's,
by
subjectivity. It's even strong. I wouldn't... I mean, human beings act... because they have beliefs. We're not robots. We have beliefs. We have dispositions. What we call agency means human beings as conscious actors with beliefs and dispositions making choices in the world. So of course they're already always formed ideologically because they have beliefs. You know, they're not acting without beliefs. Now, sometimes they can act in ways deliberately to change their beliefs. So we're not prisoners of our beliefs. Now, we would be prisoners of our beliefs, I think, if everything worked in this kind of smooth, totalizing, integrated way where there was never any contradictions between the different beliefs we hold and between the beliefs and our dispositions and between our beliefs and the lived experiences we're continually having. But it's messy. It doesn't fit together. And the fact that it doesn't totalize in that kind of way is precisely what enables agency to do things that are new. And you can talk about all these things without invoking things like free will. I mean, you know, there is lurking behind this, whether there's an uncaused agent, whether there's fully autonomous generation of action and choice. I think ultimately that's irrelevant. Everybody acts in the world as if that were the case. It's part of our constitution as human beings that we act that way. You know, there's no such thing as a person who doesn't have some sense of making choices that come from within. You know, even in the most constrained of circumstances, there's still that experience of making choices that come from within. But I don't think that helps explain anything. You know, I'm interested in explaining why social movements become explosive in some cases and reticent in others. Why people seem to be imprisoned by ideas in some cases and they're questioning everything in others. So that, you know, I'm interested in explaining that kind of variation. And for that, I think looking at things like the intensity of the contradictions between ideology and culture, the intensity of inconsistencies among different aspects of ideology, all of that is what gives you the raw material to provide explanations. And that's fully, I think, consistent with an agent-centered perspective on this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess, but doesn't the question of... I don't want to make it like a free will question because I don't know if that's exactly the framing that I'm going for, but the idea that doesn't that have some bearing on the potential of transformation, of like transforming the subject. So in a world where exploitation exists or whatever, the transformation of the subject to recognize exploitation see their subjectivity as a source of agency to change the frame in which they live. Does that not have some bearing, or at least does the knowledge of where subjective like power emerges from, as opposed to where power acts on the subject, that point of distinction, like maybe even the point of distinction between knowledge and beliefs, it seems to me.
Well, so
not the barrier.
It's crucial that people have meta-beliefs, not just beliefs. So conscious, you know, these are layered in people's consciousness. People have beliefs about their beliefs. And one kind of belief which some people have about their beliefs, but some people don't, is that their beliefs could be incorrect. Right? So part of what it means to have us to be inculcated into a scientific ideology, that is, to have as part of your beliefs a scientific enlightenment worldview. Part of what that means is to have the meta-belief that your beliefs may be wrong, which creates a constant latent tension in one's own understanding of the world, because you're perpetually prepared to change your beliefs. Some you hold as unlikely to be changed, others as vulnerable, but you never operate under a set of beliefs that say everything I know, everything I believe must be true. Some, on the other hand, some people under particularly rigid forms of authoritarian religious beliefs have the meta-belief that a major part of the beliefs I hold cannot be false. They are necessarily and forever true. And that's what we call dogmatism. And it's connected in the contemporary period especially with religious fundamentalism. Now that's a kind of belief system which then is self-protective, which blocks reflexivity. Reflexivity meaning the internal dialogues you have with yourself, about your beliefs, about your feelings. Internal moral dialogues, I think, are absolutely foundational to social change, because if you just think introspectively about your life, when you've had major changes in your sensibilities about the world, about particular beliefs, it rarely happens at the moment you hear something. It happens in your internal dialogues. You know, you worry about things. You think about them late at night, and you then have discussions with friends, and you think about them more. It's the internal dialogues that I think are really crucial to changing subjectivities. And and the capacity to have internal dialogues, though, is variable. That's something which gets encouraged in some context and sanctioned in others. I don't think it's ever completely silenced. I mean, even some of the fundamentalist creatures who sound so completely convinced about everything, I think in their hearts, to use a sort of expression that's, I think that there's always has to be some doubts that people have. That is, they have some meta-beliefs that their beliefs may not be true, though they will interpret that as the word of the devil or something, so they can discount it. By the way, if you're interested in what I think is a fantastically good book on this question of internal moral dialogue, Andrew Sayer, a British sociologist, has a wonderful book on this. It's called The Moral Economy of Class. It's a very good book. It's a Bourdieu-based critique of Bourdieu, because he does accept many of the elements of Bourdieu, but what he rejects is this notion of the human person as a kind of vessel for disposition and habitus formation, rather than a person engaged in internal dialogue. And this notion of internal moral dialogue is really at the centerpiece of his analysis. I think super interesting idea.
Is that Sayer, S-A-Y-E-R?
Yeah. Okay. I think what we should do, I think it's a natural break point. Let's take our break a little bit earlier today, and then we'll return to Terborn's analysis at 8 after 11. That'll be 10 minutes. All right. So Terborn's framework for exploring these issues. The basic objective and definition of Terborn's approach to ideology. He lays out basically four purposes. These are what he wants to accomplish by developing the theory of ideology that he does. He wants to develop concepts that make possible the historical investigation of ideology. Now, by historical, in the context of the way that word was used, it really means an account of variation, concrete variation. It doesn't necessarily mean mainly looking at development over time. It does mean that, but that's not the use of the term historical means concrete. So as opposed to just having an account of ideology that's super abstract and sort of philosophical, he wants an account that'll help you to understand variation across time and place. And that's what the word historical is meant to denote. He wants to have a concept of ideology that can encompass non-class forms of subjectivity, not just class dimensions. So he wants a flexible notion that has a more comprehensive capacity. One way of thinking about that is that we are all multiple subjects. You know, we are friends of people, students, workers, lovers. You know, we have different standings as subjects, and that we have to be formed as subjects with beliefs to function well within all of these roles, to use an old-fashioned sociological term. And he wants a concept of ideology that enables us to map that out. He wants to have a concept that gives content and specific forms to this Althusserian notion of interpolation. I'll explain what interpolation means. It's not an English word as far as I know. I'm not even sure if it's a French word, whether or as just an Althusserian word. But in any case, it's not interpolation as in mathematics, where you're putting a point in between two data points. Yeah.
Isn't it from like assujettissement or something, the subjectivation?
Well, interpolation is the French word.
Oh.
It's straight from the French, interpolation. I'll explain what that obscure word. The French, and it's true for, of course, every social theory that they use metaphors, but the French are particularly keen on using terms in a flowery way that simultaneously clarify and obscure what they're talking about. And then I think the fourth thing that Terborn wants, he wants to develop a concept of ideology that enables us to really grasp the contradictory character of ideology rather than its functional character. He doesn't want contradictions to be viewed simply as disturbances, but he wants us to have a systematic, coherent way of understanding the contradictory character of ideology. Those are the objectives. He develops this around what I think is a really beautifully framed definition. So I've quoted it directly because I think it's really a nice way of identifying the guts of what is going on here. Ideology, he defines the following way: the operation of ideology in human life involves fundamentally constituting and patterning how human beings live their lives as, and this is the key, conscious, reflecting initiators of acts in a universe of meaning. In this sense, ideology constitutes human beings as subjects. Now, that particular phrase, conscious, reflecting initiators of acts, I think that's a fantastic encapsulation of what this is all about. I like the idea of initiators of acts as a way of talking about this rather than choosers, right? So, of course, that's about making choices, but initiators of acts really, to me, captures this agent-centered view. And the fact that he puts conscious and reflecting together. So it's not just that we're thinking, but we think about thinking. And that's invoking this internal dialogue issue. And again, I really think that is an aspect of ideology and of subjectivity that is super under-theorized in social theory. There's very little discussion. It's invoked from time to time, reflexivity, reflecting, all that. Very little discussion of internal dialogue and how it works. And then about the settings which make it possible and which interrupt it. I think it's a, you know, if somebody is interested in social psychological issues and their interface with emancipatory and radical theory, that would be a terrific problem to really grapple with, internal dialogue and how it works and the way social movements mobilize it, et cetera. So that's the key thing. How are human beings formed as subjects? This idea comes out of this Althusserian word, this Althusserian tradition. Louis Althusser was a French philosopher, wrote his most important works in the 60s, the first part of the 70s. If you don't know his personal history, he was in the Communist Party, was a Communist Party intellectual, very influential in the 60s and first part of the 70s. He basically goes crazy sometime in the course of the 70s and murders his wife and is imprisoned in a mental institution for many years. I don't know the details of, you know, his personal story, but you know, it kind of ends tragically. There was so Althusser was the famous philosopher. His most famous student, who worked in the Marxist sociological and related matters, was Nikos Poulantzas, and Poulantzas killed himself. So, Althus and you know, some of my earlier work was informed by that tradition. My first publication on class was a critique of Poulantzas. So the first thing I've ever published in New Left Review was a critique of Poulantzas's work, and I was seen as in that tradition, although not as strongly, I think, as Terborn. At one point, I taught a course with Andy Levine. Andrew Levine was a philosopher here. He worked in a similar vein. We wrote, published things together. We taught a course together, and when we introduced each other. So we, at the beginning of the class, we each gave an account of the other person, and Andy said, "You know, Eric and I both work in this tradition, sometimes thought of as Althusserian. Althusser killed his wife. Poulantzas killed himself. What's going to happen in this class?" So, at any rate, the key idea that bears on the question of ideology that comes out of this French tradition is the word interpellation. As it's described in the Althusserian tradition, to interpolate a subject is to hail a subject. "Hello, you know, you subject, hi there," you know, to hail them, to address them. Does that clarify anything? not a whole lot. It's just this elliptical way of addressing the question. The way to think about it is to forget the etymology of interpellation. Appel comes, I think, from appel, to call, interpellation. Forget the etymology of it. It's simply about the formation of the human subject. And the way Terborn describes it, and I think this is what's interesting, is to see this as a dual process of what he calls subjection and qualification. Subjection and qualification. Subjection implies forming subjectivity of individuals under some general model of subjectivity. You're subjected to a particular model, subjecting people to a particular standard, particular model of subjectivity. Qualification implies the suitability of that subjectivity for roles in society. So subjection refers to the effects of ideology on individual subjectivity. Qualification refers to the effects of such subjectivity on the individual's insertion into social relations. So think about the patriarchal case. Boys, as they grow up, are subjected to a masculinist ideology about how boys should be and how they are and what's possible. They're subjected to that. If they come to hold those beliefs, that enables them to function in a particular kind of gender role. So as they grow up and they assume the roles of men, of males, within, or of men, I guess, within gender relations in their relationships to women, if they've inculcated the subjection properly, if they're fully subjected to those beliefs, then they're well suited to function within those relations. They become qualified as men. Right? So you get subjected to an ideology which qualifies you to function in particular roles. Subjection and qualification.
Sorry, could you just give the really quick one-line definition of subjection and qualification one time? What do they affect?
Subjection is the process by which the subjectivity of individuals is formed under some general model. Mm-hmm. So you're subjected to that model. In the case of patriarchy, subjected to the model of masculinity. Qualification means that that particular model makes you well suited to function in a role. Take the famous book by Bowles and Gintis, which I know some of you know, Education in Capitalist America, Schooling in Capitalist America. They make the argument about the differences between the kinds of schools that working class kids, middle class kids, and elite kids go to. And the emphasis there is on how in these different schools, children are subjected to different models of how to live in the world. In working class schools, they're subjected to a model of obedience. In middle class schools, they're subjected to a model of creativity. And in elite schools, they're subjected to a model of leadership, you know, to stylize the contrast. You learn to be workers, you learn to be professional technocrats, you learn to be bosses in the three types of schools. That subjection involves teaching a whole set of beliefs as well as inculcating a set of dispositions. So Terborn is combining these two, what I'm calling culture and ideology, into one. And these schools do a good job to the extent that they have subjected the kids in ways that when they become adults, they can function well. They're qualified to fill those roles. So if you subject kids to the elite model of becoming bosses, and then you have a change in the economic structures in which they have to be obedient workers, they're not well suited for the roles which they then are forced to fill. That would be a contradiction between subjection and qualification. They were subjected to one model, but they are called upon, once they are in the world, as autonomous, conscious initiators of action, as adults, they're being called upon to function in roles for which they have not been properly subjected. And that's one of the sources of confusion, angst, disruption in society. One of the arguments for what's going on in the Arab Spring, for example, is that there's a whole generation of young people that have become sort of overeducated relative to the carrying capacity of those economies, given the social structures and the economic structures and the forms of neoliberal dependency, et cetera, et cetera. So you get all these educated people who are being subjected to a model for their roles in the world, which there are no positions for them to fill. And there's therefore a contradiction between subjection and qualification, which then is an opening for something. Now, exactly what, of course, is historically contingent. I think the distinction between subjection and qualification is a really good one. I think it's a nice clarification in Terborn's analysis. So ideology subjects you to a model which then contingently qualifies you for a role. If everything runs smoothly, it does qualify you for the role. That would be the kind of purely functional arrangement. you're subjected to bourgeois ideology and it gets you to function well in a capitalist economy. But because the world doesn't work that way, there's often mismatches between subjection and qualification. That's ingredient one, first step in the basic conceptual machinery, is subjection and qualification. The second step is what Terborn refers to as modes of interpolation. So subjection and qualification is the meaning of interpolation. That's what we're talking about. Interpolation means subjection and qualification. The modes of interpolation refers to the content of this subjection and qualification at the ideological level, not the cultural level at the moment, just at the ideology. And the way he approaches this, again, I think is very revealing. What ideology does is gives you answers to certain questions. There are three questions that ideology answers. And the answers to these questions are what helps you function in the world. The first question is what exists, the second question is what is good, and the third question is what is possible. He describes these as three successive lines of defense of a given social order. That's one way of looking at it. I think you can also just see these as the three kinds of beliefs that constitute a person's understanding of their role in the world. And you don't have to order them in any particular way. Now, right from the start in Terborn's analysis, there is this ambiguity, which I've tried to solve by making a distinction between culture and ideology, between, particularly in the rubric, what is good, between beliefs in what is good and motivational dispositions about what is good. So, for example, in bourgeois ideology, there's the belief that competition is good. It's a good thing to compete with other people. It leads to desirable effects. It underwrites the legitimacy of inequalities, meritocracy, all sorts of things. So competition is good. That's a belief. Now, you can believe that competition is good and you can be really bad at it. You cannot be a competitive person. You can have dispositions to be cooperative, to be reciprocal, to try to work together with people and not outdo them. You can have dispositions that are at odds with the belief. Or you can have dispositions that are very competitive. So some people believe that competition is good and they're really good at competing. You know, they know how to do it. They both have the skills, but they also have the disposition, the underlying disposition to do it. Now, I would describe the inculcation of the disposition as cultural practices. And a lot of what happens in schooling in capitalist America then are cultural practices, not ideology. You know, kids are trained to be competitive in particular ways or trained to be obedient, and they're trained to the extent that they can be to have the underlying emotional dispositions connected to obedience and to competitiveness so that they feel good when they demolish a rival in a competition and they feel forlorn when they lose. You know, that's what's called a healthy competitive spirit, right? To really care about winning in a game of checkers or on the basketball court. Whereas to not have a competitive spirit is just to enjoy the game and to, you know, to not particularly care who wins or loses as long as it's fun. That's a very different way of thinking about a game than it is to be competitive. Right. So Terborn does not make this sharp distinction between beliefs and dispositions. They just kind of go together. Again, just to belabor this point, I think it's important to distinguish them. So that's particularly true for the what is good, I think, the normative aspect of these beliefs. I think there's what is good as a belief and there's what is good as a disposition, which is particularly concentrated in that aspect of interpolation. Okay, so that these are the three modes of interpolation. So that's the first step, these two aspects, the meaning, subjection and qualification, and the modes, the cognitive elements that get inculcated through ideology. The next part, the next step in Terborn's analysis is what he calls the material matrix of ideology. Now here's where the mechanisms are introduced. So far, we have some definitions of elements, but there aren't clear mechanisms. Here's where at least some mechanisms are introduced. And the key idea here is the distinction between affirmations and sanctions, and between discursive and non-discursive practices. So there's two contrasts, two distinctions that are being introduced in the material matrix of ideology: discursive and non-discursive practices, and sanctions and affirmations. First, affirmations and sanctions. In affirming practices, a practice of affirmation, this is how Terborn defines this. In an affirming practice, if an interpolated subject, that is somebody who's been formed in a particular way by subjection, if an interpolated subject acts in accordance with the dictates of the ideological discourse, then the outcomes predicted by the ideology occurs. So your beliefs shape how you act. You have beliefs about what exists, what is good, and what is possible. You hold those beliefs, you enter a situation, and you make choices. You initiate actions based on your beliefs. I mean, that's straightforward enough. The beliefs about what exists include beliefs about what will happen if you do X. So if I work hard, I'll be able to live the American dream. You know, I'll be able to have a good job and an income for my family. That's a belief about what exists. That's how this world works. An affirming practice then means if I act according to those beliefs, the prediction of the beliefs will be confirmed. Now, all of you, as adept students who have made it this far in your academic life, have engaged in a set of practices around studying hard for exams and paying attention to teachers and doing homework assignments in the expectation, you have certain beliefs about what exists in the world, that if you do so, certain things will happen. And by and large, they have happened. That's why you're still in school.
Right.
So there's a certain sense in which you've been affirmed in your expectations. So your particular set of beliefs about what exists and what is possible, and probably about what is good, too, have been continually affirmed by the acts that you've initiated as conscious, reflective initiators of actions based on those beliefs. That's affirmations. That's the affirmations part. Sanctions are the complementary side. Sanctioning practices constitute the punishments invoked for contravention of the dictates of an ideological discourse. So if you violate the predictions, the expectations of the discourse, then bad things happen. Sanctions occur. Affirmations and sanctions are one way of thinking about the mechanisms that reinforce or undermine your beliefs about what exists, what is possible, and what is good. Yeah?
Well, just to clarify, when an affirmation occurs that reaffirms someone's belief in the ideology because something good has happened to them?
No, because the expectation of, it can be something, if the ideology tells you that if you do this, something bad will happen to you, mm-hmm. and you do this and something bad happens to you, yeah. it's also affirmed.
So both affirmations and sanctions serve to reaffirm ideology.
Right.
Okay.
But one does it by affirming, you know, positively, and one is by sanctioning contravention. So
like behavior.
Right.
So affirmation is when you have correspondence between actions and results and your ideology.
Right.
And then sanctions is when you don't have that. It's when your actions don't correspond to your ideology.
No, no, when you violate the prescriptions of the... Affirmations and sanctions are both affirming. They're both reinforcing the ideology. But one is reinforcing them by giving you positive reinforcement, and the other is reinforcing the ideology by giving you negative reinforcement. This is a completely simple behaviorist model.
So, like, if you break the rules, and
you'll get punished.
Happens, you say, oh, see that happening because I broke the rules.
Right, right, exactly. Right. It's still, and there may be a, the word affirming means that you should really just think of these as positive and negative affirmations, right? They're both reinforcing the ideology, but they're doing so through positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. Rewards and punishments are basically the... So it's a simple behaviorist model, which, you know, we can have all sorts of criticisms of, just like you can have criticisms of rational choice theory. It doesn't imply, though, that these aren't important mechanisms. It's just there may be other mechanisms as well. But the idea is that ideologies are stable when the predictions of the ideology hold in the lived experience of people. That's when they have credibility. They begin to lose credibility when people work hard, they play by the rules, and they still are unemployed and destitute. That makes them question, did my beliefs about how the world works really, are they really hold? Do they really hold? And that's, you know, when there are ideological crises in societies, it's often thought of that these occur because people, quote, played by the rules, but they didn't get the results. That makes them question whether their beliefs about the system were right.
And the opposite, too, as well, right? Like, if someone doesn't play by the rules, they still get good results
right,
that they want.
Right.
I was just going to ask.
Yeah, that. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just going to say, though, that doesn't that also generally work? Like, just generally as a psychological mechanism, you know, like superstition, the same sort of thing. If you have a superstitious belief and it's reaffirmed by something, you know, like, and I just feel like that can apply to more things than ideology.
Well, but those are ideology. Superstitious belief is an ideology.
In and of itself, okay.
It is because it's a belief.
Yeah, okay, yeah. All right.
So, and as we'll see in the Elster readings in the last session, there are micro foundations, psychological foundations for all of these things.
Yes.
Right. The one other, so that's one aspect, affirmation and sanction. The other is this distinction between discursive and non-discursive practices. This is, I think, another important element in Terborn's work. It's not that he's the only one who says it, but he says it so explicitly that I think it's useful. And it's often forgotten. There has been a tendency in the last 25 years or so, 30 years or so, for the discursive aspects of practice to be given way too exclusive weight. It's not that discourse isn't important, but to assume that discourse is everything. So discourses are words. It's things that you're told. Non-discursive practices are things that happen to you. Right. So what Terborn says is that affirmations and sanctions are both discursive, words are used, and non-discursive. As he puts it, there is some difference between being pronounced dead by a hostile critic and being assassinated. Right? So being pronounced dead by a hostile critic is a discursive attack on you. Being killed is a non-discursive attack on you. It's a little hard to believe, but there are postmodernists who insist that there's no fundamental difference between being pronounced dead and being killed. They're both just discourses. And I don't even know what they're talking about, but Joan Scott has made that statement in public. And that's, I understand what it means if what is said is that pronouncements about being assassinated and pronouncements about being criticized as dead are both pronouncements. That's clear enough. I just don't understand what it means to say that there's actually no difference between the things which are being pronounced. But,
I think the context in which she might have said that is like the idea that there's still not an exact, like, I mean, there's still scientific questions about when the moment of death is, or like,
no, she was I mean, she wasn't being that careful. At least I was at a talk when she said this, and there was no hint that there was some subtle meaning of calling into question the moment of death as opposed to the condition of... Do you know the Monty Python routine about the parrot?
Yeah.
The dead parrot? Okay.
And then the other question I had was just, what about the idea, though, that even things that happen to subjects, I mean, the fact that they're able to make sense out of it is only through language, right? The way that they make sense of an act of exploitation on them is there's some framing of the way in which they think about it that causes them to actually...
Right. So the key issue there is where how literally you mean the only in the only through language. So it is true that everything that happens to you non-discursively, because we are conscious, reflective initiators of action, we think about, we interpret. So if you believe that our interpretations are such that universally they completely determine the cognitive effect of things that happen to us, and that there's no autonomy whatsoever, that's the view that we're prisoners of our thoughts, of our beliefs. So if you... and that's a very strong... That's a view that says that everything is discourse, either in the sense that you are given words or that you have words, but there's no such thing as lived experience. It's an empty category. That all there is interpreted experience, not lived experience. And I don't think that's right. I just think that's fact. I think that's a bad theory of human subjectivity. Yeah.
The distinction on those lines is kind of an oversimplification. Like, in the sense that, so basically the idea is that if people have particular ways of thinking about things, then, I mean, is it possible to think about things without language, is basically the question, right?
No, of course it's not, but that doesn't mean that how you think about things is dictated by language.
It's possible to think about things without language.
No, it's just saying that it's not that language doesn't give you a unique outcome to the... You can't think without language, but it's also not true that there's only one thought you can have given
no.
your language.
Oh, no,
so the language isn't a machine that produces subjective interpretation from
those cases of humans who never learned a language. Obviously, they could still think. So they didn't need language to think.
It's not so clear that people that humans who have been raised with no language have anything but the most limited cognitive capacities.
There was a case of a child abuse case where this person was kept in a closet for like until they were a teenager. I mean, I think that would be crazy to say this girl wasn't thinking. I mean,
well,
she never developed language.
Yeah. So no, it's not crazy. I mean, that's the cognitive psychologists who have studied these rare cases of people who have been raised completely without language and in isolation. There's first of all, brain development is heavily affected by stimulus, so there's tremendous cognitive impairment if you have no language ability, but also all sorts of reasoning. If by thinking you mean your ability to make deductions from things, all sorts of reasoning does require language, not just neural tissue. You know, so, but I mean, this. My point, I mean, this has to do this issue about whether or not the correct fact that you need discourses in order to interpret the world implies that discourses determine the interpretations of the world. The first is true, the second is false. It's a non sequitur. I mean, I think it's basically a non sequitur. That sometimes discourses do. My point about the dogmatism before is sometimes your discourses are such that they do give you a 99.9% prediction as to how the interpretation will follow from the discourse, because the cognitive structures that are built around that discourse have the kind of rigidity and lack of meta thinking, you know, no lack of reflexive thinking about thinking, that yes, for those kinds of discourses, lived experience, an outsider can predict exactly how it's going to be interpreted. But that's only one possible cognitive structure. And the thing about human beings and our cognitive capacities is that we do have meta-thinking, we have thinking about thinking, and we have a way of processing experience which makes it way less determinate how interpretations follow from lived experiences, even if you knew all the discourses.
Yeah. So are you using discourse in a very structured sense, as in a discourse provides rules for interpretation? Similar to an ideology, is that?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity. Sometimes discourse is used as almost identically to the way I'm using ideology. Sometimes it means language. It's even more encompassing. So I'm not being very specific here in my comment about the. This gets into a set of methodological issues about the meaning of science, essentially. This is what this ultimately comes down to, which is a big philosophical set of issues. I adopt what I call a realist theory of science, and it would take a lot for us to get into that. We'll do a little bit of that in the lecture on mystification. I think that's the next. Is the next one mystification or the next one legitimation and hegemony?
Mystification.
Mystification is next. Okay, so on Wednesday in the mystification, since mystification has to do with talking about the way ideology distorts our answer to the question, what exists, especially, in order to make the claim of distortion, you have to have a standard. And that, therefore, brings into question this issue of what it means to have a scientific critique of ideology. So that's something we'll be talking about on Wednesday. So let me just finish. The discursive and non-discursive point is, Terborn wants to say that ideologies function in the world and are incorporated into our subjectivity through affirmations and sanctions, which are not just being told things. So it's not just that the teacher stands up in the front of the class and instructs you as to what you should believe. There's all sorts of non-discursive things going on in classrooms that affect how you come to believe what you believe, around what exists, what is good, and what is possible. And of course, all of these interact with neuropsychological cognitive mechanisms of various sorts, which Terborn regards as a black box. He doesn't delve, except in the affirmations and sanctions, there's this thin kind of behaviorism, reinforcement kind of view. He doesn't have any other psychological mechanisms. The contradictions and transformations of ideology. I think we have time just to very briefly go through these. So one way of using all this stuff, sanctions, affirmations, qualifications, subjections, this is a nice vocabulary. One way of doing this is to use this to develop a theory of the totalized subject that's functionally inserted into a set of social relations and is incapable of autonomous resistance, right? So you can have this hyper-functionalist totalizing account of ideology. You could use these concepts in that way. Terborn is interested, however, in deploying these concepts in a way that enable us to understand transformation. Rather than just reproduction. At the heart of his particular account is what he would, I think this is the term he uses, if not, it's my gloss on his term, what I would call an intergenerational perspective on ideology. So it's basically the idea that transformations of ideologies are most likely to occur between generations rather than within generations. That's the kind of proposition. The background context for this is the view that transformations of ideologies always presuppose an existing ideology. So we should think of the problem of new ideologies, new beliefs occurring as always a transformation of something, as opposed to simply the production of new beliefs. People are already have beliefs, and those beliefs get transformed. And the question is, under what conditions? And his view is that this is most likely to happen between generations rather than within. people are transformed from one kind of subject to another rather than from being non-subjects into subjects. Babies are transformed from being non-subjects into subjects in the context of especially families, but also communities. But subjects are transformed from being one kind of subject into another. He states this as follows: a parental generation will always mold its children according to its own form of subjectivity. Parents have a particular set of beliefs about what exists, what is possible, and what is good, and they will always form their own children according to their own beliefs as to what exists, what is possible, and what is good. And if ecological, demographic, socioeconomic, and any inter-societal relations remain the same, the younger generation will face exactly the same affirmations and sanctions of the existing ideologies as the parental ones. So if the environment of the parents remains constant, and they mold their children according to the same beliefs that they have about what exists, what is good, and what is possible, then their children are going to face exactly the same sanctions and affirmations, discursive and non-discursive, when they enter the world. The younger generation will face exactly the same affirmations and sanctions of the existing ideologies as the parental one. It follows that the explanation of the generation of ideologies, how new ideologies emerge and are disseminated, will have to start from processes of change in the structure of a given society. It is these changes, then, which constitute the material determination of the rise of ideologies. So ideologies arise, new ones take hold, because there's a change in the affirmations and sanctions in the world to which people are subjected. Even though they begin that process by having been molded in the same model as their parents. This is in contrast to an idealist view, which assumes, again, this is to quote Terborn, that assumes that just through the power of ideological imagination, each new generation of humans can emancipate themselves from the ideological formation of their parents, even though facing exactly the same situations as the latter. So the point here is a critique of a kind of idealist view which imagines that a charismatic leader with fantastically cool ideas could manage to transform the ideologies of people, even if nothing had changed in the environment of affirmations and sanctions which had stably reproduced ideologies in the past. Such charismatic leaders may be important, but they only have effects in the world if they intersect a context in which the affirmations and sanctions that people are experiencing are no longer corresponding to the answers to the question, what exists, what is possible, and what is good, that the actors have had. That's a proposition, though. You know, this could be wrong. This could be kind of examined. If we look at the historical moments where big new ideological currents seem to emerge and be diffused rapidly, the question would be, was this occurring in a setting in which there was a erosion of the affirmations and sanctions of the previous ideology already in place, and therefore a set of contradictions and tensions that made people disposed to hear the new ideas, or was everything just chugging along fine, just stably? There was no indication of any erosion of the previous system of beliefs, and it was just the charisma and ideological power of the actor that enabled these transformations to occur. Terborn's argument that this is a materialist process, materialist as opposed to idealist, doesn't deny the power of ideas. Ideas are terrifically important here. He's just saying that under what conditions are ideas likely to be powerful and to have a compelling character for transformation? And for that, he argues, there must be this dislocation between affirmations and sanctions and the existing forms of subjectivity. I think this pretty much gets us to the end of these of the exposition. There are other aspects of Terborn's argument which I haven't discussed. He has this distinction between historical and existential ideologies. ego and alter ideologies. So he makes lots of distinctions. It's a multiple dimensional space that he's laying out. I think nearly all of his distinctions are interesting and worthwhile. The distinction between ego and alter ideologies is a really interesting one. I mean, just to tell you what that is, an ego ideology is my ideology about what is good for me, and my alter ideology is my ideology of what is good for you within a set of relations. So men have ego ideologies about how men should behave and alter ideologies about how women should behave. Right? So those can also get disrupted. They can disrupt their views about women and not their views about men. So men can remain highly masculinist and feel that women should be like men. So he's just adding more dimensions upon which variation and contradiction can occur. That's, I think, the big strength of his argument. It's not more dimensions upon which everything can fit together. It's more dimensions upon which everything can fall apart. Okay. On Wednesday, we will do two things. We will organize rides for everybody in the class for the weekend, and we will demystify mystification.